Hello, listeners. Nina here with some really fun news about a live event I am hosting this summer in Minneapolis. That is where listeners and readers will come together to hear a live style podcast. Why am I calling it a live style? That is because it will not be recorded. I will be in discussion with my fantastic assistant producer, Rebecca Jacobs. We will be highlighting the top five pieces of friendship advice that we have no doubt will change your life for the better. We are 100% certain of it. I would be so thrilled to meet you. It is on Wednesday, July 29th in the early evening. You can find more information at ninabadzin.com/events. My last name is Badzin. So it's ninabadzin.com/events. And that will take you directly to the link for the ticket. I cannot wait to meet more of you. And now on to today's episode. Welcome to Dear Nina, Conversations About Friendship. I am your host, Nina Badzin. I've been writing about friendship for over a decade, podcasting about it for almost 5 years. Usually I am speaking about female friendship, but I am hearing more and more from listeners who are worried about the men in their lives. Their husbands don't seem to maintain friendships. Their sons are more isolated than they'd like. Their brothers, their dads, listeners are worried about them. So when I saw Andrew McCarthy wrote a book about male friendship called Who Needs Friends? An Unscientific Examination of Male Friendship Across America, I knew that I had to talk to him. Yes, I am talking about that Andrew McCarthy, the actor, director, travel writer. But in this conversation, we are not talking about Pretty in Pink or Mannequin or the Brat Pack. We're talking about his book, Who Needs Friends? And the question that set this friendship project in motion when his son said to him, "You don't really have any friends, do you, Dad?" This episode with Andrew is, yes, about male friendship, but there are some big themes that apply to everyone. Old friends, newer friends, loneliness, showing up, physically showing up, which Andrew does a lot of in this book, why men might sometimes drift away from one another. And we also talk about the positive parts of men's friendships. There are many, and what women can learn from them. One big takeaway from me in my conversation with Andrew and in his book, he does such a great job discussing something that's hard to name in all friendships, is how important it is to have a sense of safety with someone that you are going to have a deep friendship with. You can't just trust somebody without feeling safe with them, without feeling like your information will stay with them, that they will be there for you. And it's not a word I have used much before, and I encountered it in Andrew's book, and it really stuck with me. One thing to note in this episode is that we refer several times to another episode, which was 184 with Dr. Jeffrey Hall, who was such a fun guest, somebody that Andrew quotes in his book as well. We refer to it many times in this episode without giving it the episode number. It will also be in the show notes. I'm excited for everybody to hear this conversation, and you have to get all the way to the end to hear a very special moment, which I'm just going to spoil for you right here when I thank Andrew for coming on the show. And he says, "Thank you, Nina. I really appreciate it. I love your podcast." I will be making that into some kind of social media moment. How could I not? Hello, I am speaking to Andrew McCarthy. All right, here you go. Welcome, Andrew.
Hi, Daniel. Good to be with you.
Most of our listeners are women, and one thing I hear is the concern they have for the men in their life. Nobody here in this show needs to be convinced that friendships matter, that this is something we need to prioritize, but they struggle helping the men in their life. And your book, Who Needs Friends, captures this so beautifully. Starts with this gut punch with your oldest, Sam, saying, "You don't really have any friends, do you, Dad?" And I was curious about what that must have felt like, because you do technically have friends. You actually aren't someone who doesn't have friends. So what would make him say that?
Well, I had a number of really close friends when I was a young man, when I first moved to New York. And I had several guys who were really instrumental in me sort of becoming who I would become in life. Over time, they moved away. I got busy with my career. I then started having my own family. They had their family. It evolved that I hadn't seen a number of them in 10, 21, 30 years. When my son did say that, my son and I were sitting in the kitchen and he was playing his guitar and I was just sitting there sipping tea, and he was telling a story about one of his buds. And I said, "My Rocco's such a fool, Sam." And he goes, yeah, I know. I love him." And that's when he just spoke to me. He goes, "You don't really have friends, do you, Dad?" I knew it affected me because I acted instantly like it didn't affect me, because I don't want my kids to see that he had a nerve, thought about it for a second. And I just said, "Yes, Sam, I do have friends, like you said, but I just don't see them. But I know they're there, and that's enough." That was the rest of that thought. That's what I told myself for a long time. It's enough. I know that. I know Chevy's out there. I know Matthew's out there. I know. When he left, I did. I sat in the kitchen and I just thought, you know, it's not enough. I need to go see my friends. That's what it evolved into, this sort of 10,000-mile road trip across America, crisscrossing the country to go see my oldest, dearest friend who I hadn't so long, and let them know how meaningful they were in my life, which is something we don't tell each other when we're young, you know, but now that we're old, I just wanted to make a point, though, you know, you really matter to me and you've had such an effect in my life. When I finished the trip, if there was one takeaway, I just felt so much safer after the trip. And I felt like I had a net under me in a way that I usually don't in life. So it had a profound effect on me.
I like the word safety in this because while on one hand you knew you had these friends and in theory they would be there for you no matter what because they have been there for you, you've been there for them, to actually prove it again for this period of your life, that would make sense. You can't just know something in theory after a certain number of years.
Well, things do start to decay and change or whatever, but that's sort of one of the definitions of true friendship, isn't it? That you see somebody and then it's like it was yesterday. I mean, people say that all the time. But for me, I think one of the guys, one of my friends, I think, asked, I said, what's one word that describes friendship? What's the most important word for you? And trust is a common word. But for me, it's that feeling of safety. You know, I just like, you've got me and you're not want anything. I'm safe with you. Me, who I am, is safe with you, who you are. And that is not something I experience a lot in my day-to-day life, out in the world, trying to be the guy, doing stuff and all that. And it's not something I realized I was yearning for or missing until I experienced it again. The relief I felt in that is profound.
Something I want to touch on, it reminds me of something you were just saying, like maybe you don't feel it in your everyday life. And I know you can't speak for all men, but you do encounter a lot of men, both your own friends, but also people you meet on the road. And there seems to be a drumbeat of a similar concept. They talk about this pressure in their everyday life to be the provider and where friendship maybe can't fit into that. Can you talk about
that
a little
bit? Well, I did find that. I thought it was one of the most common thread through all men that I can. And yeah, and I started, as I was going to see my old friends, I started randomly going up to people, literally raised around and go, excuse me, can I talk to you about your friends? And guys would look at me like, yeah, your mind. But the interesting thing was, after the initial sort of taken aback, not one of them said no to me. Everybody just was, yeah, okay. It evolved in most guys. It turned up by the end of the conversation. You know, I've never talked about this before. They all wanted to keep talking when I was ready to move on. One of the universal things was the need to provide, the sense of you need to take care, because what does a man do but take care and provide? And the degree to which we are able or unable to do that has a lot to do with our self-esteem. However much I can try and tell that to my wife, because my wife is much more capable and can provide better than I can in many aspects of our life. But her self-esteem doesn't seem as tied into it as mine does. But when I would say that to the guys, they would just look at me and go, of course, absolutely, that's what I do. Underneath it all, I can't, you know, years when I'm providing, meaning making money and showing up and doing things that I feel good about myself and my value and worth and life. And so consequently, I'm more relaxed and I'm more generous and gracious and all that stuff. If I'm feeling less like I'm not getting it done, I tend to be more defensive, more angry because I'm frightened, you know, and anger comes a lot from wanting control, and control comes from fear and, you know, all that stuff. So it's a huge issue, my experience, for me and for guys as well. And I'm not one of those macho men that want to be, you know, in control and I provide, I'm a provider. None of that nonsense. I don't have that aspect. I don't have any kind of John Wayne syndrome, but I do feel a certain obligation. Like I asked one of my friends, I said, Don, do you feel this? And he goes, of course.
I want to talk about some of these reunions because a lot of what I know my listeners will find interesting is this mix of old friends and newer friends. I mean, newer compared to some of those foundational friendships. I highlighted so many things that I had to control myself because I have pages of notes of quotes that I like would love to read to you of your own work, but you wrote it.
Oh, I love hearing good things back to me. Yes.
Okay. Well, I'm going to read one good for this moment right here where we're going to get into some of these friendships and the difference between the old friends and the new friends. And you said, my friendships with Sevi, Matthew, and Eddie are, as Eddie aptly labeled them, foundational relationships. While nothing can replace those early connections, friends made later in life have rich value, if for no other reason than that it can be so much more difficult to make friends as we get older. They require a conscious and active and vulnerable making commitment in a way those early friendships did not, when friendships seem to just happen. And they can propel us into the future in a way those longtime friendships don't necessarily. The lack of history with newer friends can promote feelings of expansion. A fresh outside perspective can prove liberating. I'll tell you really fast, I was on NPR having to defend why we need to keep our old friends. That was the assignment. That was the interview. Was I was defending why it's a good sign of your social health if you can keep up some old friends, not all of them. And then, of course, I got so many comments angry comments on Facebook and stuff about how that doesn't mean anything and all that matters is new friends. And I, of course, think new friends are important too. It's just I was put in that position. Both are really important. I love that in your book. Both kinds of friendships are here. Let's go back to Sevi. Like, so rewinding from that quote, he was the first friend you saw. What can you tell us about that part of your trip? It was the impetus. And I don't even know that you meant to see other friends after that. It felt like you, it kind of happened.
No, yeah. So after Sam left, I thought about it for a minute. So I started calling my three friends. My three other friends immediately leapt to mind, Sevi, Eddie, and my friend Matthew. And so I called them all up. We said, yeah, let's run. We made plans. I was going to fly down to each one individually. And invariably, each one of them canceled on me. My friend Sevi, I thought, he was only in Baltimore. He's only 4 hours away. And he canceled on me a couple of times. And I knew he'd had back problems, whatever. And so I just got in the car and I went down to see him unannounced. Like, this is ridiculous. I'm going to see my friend. He just seemed evasive in a way that he was always a bit slippery, but he seemed evasive in a way that seemed odd. And, you know, this was now front of my mind. I needed to see at least one of my friends, since they all seemed to have rejected me. I went down to see him. He was in a tough way. He'd had terrible back trouble, and so he'd become sort of a shut-in. And I know for myself that I love to be alone. I'm very much happy in my own company, but, you know, you can slip over into isolation very quickly without noticing the invisible line. So it was just really valuable to see him again. And then so your guest in your last week's podcast was talking about that famous thing of it takes 200 hours to make a good friend and how consistency is so important. I went down the next weekend to see him again. And then I went down to see him again. Then it just sort of evolved that I wanted to see my next friend and started driving. And then I sort of evolved that I started talking to other men. And then somewhere in that early stage, somewhere in West Virginia, probably had this idea that maybe there was a book here about men and their relationships to each other. Women are so much better at connecting and checking in and all that kind of stuff. And guys just don't really do that. Women can set a higher bar, whereas guys will tolerate, I think, a lot more than women will sometimes in each other. Like my wife, who has deep friendships and many, 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 many more than I ever will. But she can really run a full emotional gamut with her friends. Whereas I just kind of go, that's Sevi. Like my wife goes, Sevi's slippery, Andrew. I'm like, I know, it's my friend. I'm willing to make allowances for him. I don't need all my friends to fill all my needs. Sevi fills this certain need that I have. I trust him utterly, and I feel safe with him. That's enough for me.
Women can really learn from that. The way you said it in the book, you said that men tend to, of course, you know, we're always generalizing, men tend to work those flaws into the friendship instead of having to discuss them. People have to apologize for them. Like, none of that. It's like you maybe discover the flaw and then you work it into the friendship. It's part
absolutely
of the friendship.
And like my friend Sevi, when he does a little slippery thing, I go, don't do a Sevi on me. Come on now. What's going on? You know what I mean? He knows exactly what I'm talking about. And it's honoring his privacy a little bit and giving respect for who he actually is. I mean, not actively doing that, but that seems to be what happens when I do that. And it lets him know I see you and I still like you and love you. I see your imperfection or whatever you're holding back for yourself. And that's fine. I'm still your friend. And I think that's hugely valuable. And he sees, like the other day, he called me and he said, how you doing? I go, fine. He goes, okay, I know what that means. And it was enough. And then I laughed and relaxed a little bit and I was able to talk to him. I guess that's shorthand or something, but it's also, in the best version of it, a respect for each other's privacy in a certain way, I think. Because you're my dear friend, you don't have to know everything about me. I don't need to know everything about you. If you want to share that with me, okay, great. But, you know, if not, that's fine too. Anyway, I digress.
No, I think women struggle more with that, with the expectation that you're going to reveal everything. I think a little more privacy and respect for people making decisions that don't necessarily have to be explained would be a good thing for more women to take on. I actually think and hope that a lot of women will read your book and share it with the men in their life, but also read it for themselves, because I think we can learn a lot from maybe taking the pressure down a notch in some of these friendships. Although I am glad you showed up, because no matter what, you do have to show up eventually. And yes, like last week's guest, who you quote in the book, Jeff Hall, on those 200 hours, you already put those in with each one of those friends. This book to me is not about those 200 hours. The book to me was about, okay, yes, you put that time in once upon a time. That's how you are so close, but they can't take you forever. Like in spirit, they can. But that showing up that you did in this book is so important.
Showing up is everything. I mean, that's really something I've learned in the last 10 years of my life. That old silly line, that, you know, 90% of life is showing up. I think that's absolutely, without question, true. And just show up in whatever shape and to whatever degree you can, show up. And that's really important to me. And that's grown to be very important to me. One of the things that I learned from something you said a minute ago made me think of it. I realized one of my real failings as a parent, because kids don't listen to us, right? Our kids don't listen to me once I get older. You know, they don't listen, but they model. They see what we model for them. One of my biggest failings as a parent was that I didn't model friendship behavior with my kids. My kids didn't see my buds coming over, me going out to play basketball on Tuesday night with them, because I am such a sort of solitary person, and my family takes up a lot of my active space, and I'm happy with that, and my work and all this other stuff. So I don't have an active friend group in that way. It was a real failing that my kids see that. I really realized that when I was doing this book, that, wow, that's something that I didn't teach them well. And I say, of course you have to have your friends, but it's cheap. And even like at the end of the book, I do talk much more now to my friends on the phone, and we'll text or talk on the phone a lot more since we reconnected. And Sam did say, he said, wow, Dad, it's so nice to see you talking to your friends like that. I just never heard you do that. It made me feel really nice, because it's like, oh, yeah. And kids are, you know, mirror back the truth to it. My kids have got, because my wife is so good at it, at friendship, that they've learned a little bit better model. They have a do and don't in front of them, how to do it and how not to do it. So if that makes any sense, I realized what a failing it had been of mine to not actively maintain those friendships in a daily way for my kids to see that.
It's a good message for dads, because it shouldn't all come from the mom. If it's not too personal to ask, did you see it modeled with your parents?
My nicest memories of my childhood with my parents that aren't active between us was they used to play at bridge every Tuesday night. And about once a month, it would be at our house. And we used to sit at the top of the stairs and sneak down and eavesdrop on them playing bridge. You know what I mean? And that was the nicest. Yep. I loved seeing hearing my mother laugh. I never remember my mother laughing in our daily life. But when she was playing bridge and all, I guess because she had some wine or something, I'd hear her laughing. That was such the nicest memory I have of them growing up, I think, in many ways. And my father had one friend who used to come over all the time. They used to sit around, smoke cigars, and play Big Shot. But I used to like being in that room when they were hanging out until they would kick me out. So I guess I haven't thought about it much, but I mean, it was when I saw my parents the most relaxed. And I saw them, you know, as a kid, you never see your parents as outside of your own experience. And it was the beginning of seeing them as individual people, which is, of course, one of the greatest moments in life when you realize, oh, I'm growing up, I see my parents as someone having their own separate life from me. When I would see them doing that, I experienced that in a pleasant way.
Oh, that's so true. You know, I talk often about one of the benefits of couple friends, why it's good to bother having couple friends is for your marriage, you get to see your spouse put on their best face forward in a way we don't always at home. Yes, ideally, it'd be nice if at home we were like that too. But you go out with another couple, you know, maybe you turn around, you're like, oh, wait, my husband is funny. He's just funny. He's
even better. You can see the other person is a pretty. Well, see, Dan thinks I'm funny. You
know? Right.
Or me thinks
right.
I'm funny. Yeah. Okay.
Exactly. Of course, I have thought about why it's important to model friendship for the kids, but I hadn't really thought about it for the exact reason you just said, which is similar to why it's good to have couple friends, so that your kids can see you as this different person than just their parent, the spouse of their other parent or whatever, co-parent, whatever these days. It is huge. My parents also, bridge was major. I was like really smiling when you said that. Bridge was a huge part of their social life. Couples, my dad passed away 4 years ago from Parkinson's. He was diagnosed in his late 50s. He died at 80. I mean, so it was really advanced. But bridge, he couldn't play at the end. He couldn't play those last few years. He really couldn't keep up. The men he played bridge with allowed him to stay really longer than it probably was fun for them, because it slowed the game down and everything. But that bridge was like a lifeline. It's so good to have something like that.
Well, I'm sure you know much more of the statistics and everything. And if I'm really beginning to see this. I'm getting older. How of all the statistics I learned doing this book, the biggest one was that 85-year Harvard study where it said the single most important thing to a longer, healthier, happy life is not career or this or that, but it's connection.
Social connections, yeah.
And I really begin to see that. That's a massive.
Yeah. And another thing Bridge did, if you think about it, for your parents and mine, it had something on the calendar. It like existed higher than it, you don't have to schedule. Well, scheduling is the worst part of friendship. Think about how your friends in this book, you're like, I'm coming. And they're like, great. And then they're like, nope, I'm busy. I have this, this, and this. I love that you went anyway. Scheduling is the hardest part of maintaining friendships. And so that's why pickleball is so huge now, because it's just on the calendar. You don't have to think about it all the time. On Tuesdays, we play pickleball. Women, for now, right now, I've been playing for over a decade, but Mahjong is huge.
My wife's a big Mahjong player. Yeah, she plays. She has a group that she plays with all the time. Yeah.
Same thing. So it's on the schedule. It kind of exists higher than you. It's already on the calendar. and there's something to do while you're talking. There's actually doing. And
that doing while you're talking, particularly for guys, because guys are not going to get together and have a cup of coffee. That's just not going to happen. People joke, oh, God, I'm going to go play golf or whatever. But, you know, the stuff that happens in that camaraderie is really valuable. And it's like toddlers in a certain way. The parallel play is really important because very rarely do you just sort of sit around and talk about stuff as a guy. You're doing something. And the doing connects you. One of my newest friends that I made, well, 10 years now we've been friends, but we became friends because I moved in next door to him and I had to build a basketball hoop for my son who was learning. So we bought this basketball. I'm terrible at doing it yourself. And he happened to be great. So he came over and helped me. And for 4 hours, we finally built this basketball hoop. Well, he did really. And I just sort of gave him the screwdriver. And that was the beginning of our friendship. We've never talked about that, but I know that's how that friendship started.
Also, wait, so you asked him to help you?
Yeah, he could have poked his head over. Oh, what do you got? Open your basketball hoop. I go, dude, do you know how to do things? Where? You know, and all that.
I asked that because it's a huge part of making friends and keeping friends is asking people for help. And we just forget that. It tells the other person that you trust them with your vulnerability. I can't do this thing. Can you help me? It could be something really small, like I need a ride to the airport, or huge.
It's huge. Admitting vulnerability is, of course, for a guy, because if you admit vulnerability, that's admitting weakness. That somehow that's gotten misconstrued. They've gotten tied together when they have nothing to do with each other. And yet, if I admit vulnerability, then it could be construed as weakness. And the one thing a man can't be is weak. So we tend not to want to do that, of course. And it's ludicrous and ridiculous. But when you do ask someone for help, you know, I do a lot of travel writing and I don't speak any other languages. So what I invariably do is go up to people when I'm trying to break through. And I'm pretty self-contained sometimes. And so I'll just go up and go, can you help me? People never say no, because it allows them to feel empowered. They don't feel threatened then, so they don't have to behave defensively. It's one of the best things we can do is to ask for help. And of course, it's the hardest thing to do, but often with little things, when I don't even need help, I'll ask for help because it just breaks down that barrier and allows then people to feel comfortable. You know, the more important the thing is, the harder it is to ask for help. So I often ask for help with things I often don't even need help, but it's just a way for me to break ice.
It's a good practice. It's a good way to bridge that gap between a person. Esther Perel had something recently I saw going around. She does a lot of work on marriages, but she also talks about friendships and just the danger out there of self-reliance. Everybody feeling like they have to do everything for themselves, which leads to total lack of community. There's friendship and then there's community, and they're not always the same thing. You can have a good community and you might not have a good one-to-one, but it's important to have both in our life. Part of having community is acknowledging we have needs. We can't do everything on our own.
Well, the lone wolf thing is a massive problem for guys, because that sort of manhood, American manhood, has evolved. In the 1800s, men used to write basically love letters to each other. You know, Abraham Lincoln and Joshua Speed were the dearest friends and had shared a bed even. And, you know, some people are saying it was a sexual relationship, but there was a lot. There was so much intimacy and spoken intimacy among men. And somewhere between the Victoria and post-World War II to the John Wayne evolution of carry your own water and be stoic and silent, the idea of manhood changed to that. And it's really been a disservice to guys, I think. That notion of just being solitary and self-contained is so dangerous to us. And I mean, I'm very much not a macho dude, but I can certainly be very self-contained and solitary. And even just guys I met on the road to this trip, some guys, I'm thinking of one guy I met in Nevada, a tiny town in Elko, Nevada. And he said, yeah, I never had much juice for friendship. He was a lovely guy, interesting guy, but he was pretty encased in himself. It's rough. I think that's rough.
As we talked about that Harvard study, that's not going to bode well, probably, in the end. One thing I actually found really surprising, happily surprising, in your book is how many guys actually did have deep friendships, though. More than I would have thought. I think I would have assumed that you were going to have more conversations like the one you just said. And you used the word skittish. That's a great word. Like, everyone was skittish at first. They didn't necessarily want to talk about it at first. But then they would open up to you. And many of them did have these stories of guys who they were like, I don't even know how I would live without this person. I'm going to die when he dies. That was the sense.
Yeah, it was amazing. There were a couple of guys I met in Ohio that were in their 70s that had been friends for 60 years. Yeah, they said a wonderful thing. But yeah, we started recently saying I love you to each other. I tell my kids I love them. I tell my wife I love them. Why can't I tell my best friend for 60 years I love them? You know, they were ex-cops and they were tough guys, but mm-hmm. they were awesome, those guys. And, you know, yeah, a couple of guys I met down in Austin, Texas, too. They'd been friends for a decade. And then like, I don't know what my life would have been without him. It wasn't so much small. Envied that when they said that, something I can't even comprehend, to have that kind of daily friendship and that kind of support, a rock next to you like that. I really envy that. It's not something temperamentally I might not be suited for, but also it just hasn't been I wasn't lucky enough to have that experience. But yeah, I did encounter guys who had that. And they tended to be a little gentler and a little more open-minded, a little more compassionate than guys who would go it alone.
On loneliness, by the way, I don't know if you got all the way through my interview with Jeff Hall, but he did say something kind of interesting that he's working on next. Like, he always has these studies. The 200-hour studies was probably 7 years ago or so. His next one that he hasn't quite done yet, he's hypothesizing, then he'll put it into his relationship lab at the university, that telling people they're lonely may be causing more loneliness than there really is.
Yep.
I thought that was kind of interesting. What did you think of that?
I thought that was fascinating when you had that part of your conversation. And that notion that everybody is lonely, and there's nothing wrong with that, because everybody gets lonely at certain moments. But then the notion that there's something wrong then with that. And I thought that was really interesting, this whole lonely thing that you got on to. Talk more about that.
He was saying, and it spoke to me too, that loneliness is actually the solution,
right,
not the problem.
Really,
just like, right? Just like when you have pain, right? I think about, actually, as I was reading your book, you're not going to believe this, was not as bad as what Sevi was dealing with at all. But I had a back spasm. My back went out last week, and I'm much better now. I'm mobile and everything. But I mean, I was like in bed reading your book, although laying down was uncomfortable and sitting was uncomfortable. Like, you have to constantly change. But I was thinking about the loneliness thing, the back pain, and how that spasm on the back actually is something to be grateful for. It was to save my back from, I was obviously doing something, and it was to like save me from further injury. And I think loneliness is kind of the same thing. It's that feeling that you might get is the solution. It's to tell you, okay, time to connect. You have to do something about it. It's not magically going to happen that you're going to feel better, but it's the sign that you're alone too much, maybe, that you haven't put as much time into the social connection.
Well, and what's so interesting about that, it becomes sort of a positive thing, not necessarily, as opposed to this negative and lacking in some self-indictment about that you're a failure and a loser because you're lonely. But it's spurring you to action in a certain way. It was just turning it on its head. That was fascinating.
Yeah, like it's normal. Actually, it would be concerning if you had no friends and no real social connections and felt no loneliness. It's the inverse. It's like the lack of loneliness is the issue, not feeling lonely, not lack. Obviously, if you have a very full social life, you may not feel it. Although that's what our episode really was about, that people in their 20s are very connected, are busy. They're always doing stuff, but they still may feel a sense of loneliness, but it's more like they're just not settled. That's his current study. Okay, finally, I want to just read you one comment from my Facebook group. I didn't say I was interviewing you, as I told you before we recorded, just in case you were super busy and couldn't do it. I didn't want to tell anybody. But I just said, I'm interviewing a great guest about male friendship. What are your thoughts on male friendship? And this one comment kind of encompasses them all. She said, I find it sad that my husband puts so little effort into maintaining his friendships. By now, our children are teenagers, almost grown up, and I have so much time for my own friends. I didn't have so much time in the past either, but over the past few years, that has improved so much, and I don't want to miss any more of my friendships. My husband, on the other hand, hardly maintains his contacts, and he doesn't want any advice from me. My husband is such an interesting person to talk to. I feel like he doesn't even see his own potential. I thought that was sweet. It's a shame. But the more I try to convince him to spend time with friends, the less he seems to want to. At least that's how it feels. He does enjoy couple evenings. Still, I think it would be important for him to also do friendship stuff on his own. There's quite a big discrepancy now between the time I spend with friends and him. What advice can you give, not just her, all my listeners who I kind of started with are concerned. Is there anything they can say to their husbands or just the men in their life to spend more time with friends?
Well, I could go hang out with that dude because I'm exactly the same. My wife would say the same thing. I am not a social scientist. When I told my wife I was writing a book about friendship, she went, you are writing a book about friendship? I go, yeah, but I'm perfect for it because I'm a guy with no friends. So who better to write a book about friendship than a guy who has let his friendships atrophy? I do think guys do best when they're in action, in motion. What was great about rekindling my friendships, and it with good fodder for a book, is that I drove 10,000 miles to go see them all. You know what I mean? To go do something. I think a lot of us guys judge our life by what we achieve. That I drove to go see them meant a lot to me. It was proof to not necessarily to them, but to me. And it was to them. They go, I can't believe you drove here to see me. It was proof to me that this is important to me and it was a value. And so again, logged in the miles, literally, and made the effort. Action for guys is equivalent to love. For me, it's been very helpful.
That's beautiful. Okay, two more things. I lied. It wasn't the last one. How do they feel about being in the book? I know they're not all the same, but just from a writer perspective, that's sort of interesting to me in a memoir.
Well, I gave it to, well, I offered to everyone. I go, do you want to read what I wrote about you? And three said yes. And two just said, no, I'm good.
That's trust right there.
I said, well, you're going to have to buy it then because I'm not giving you. My friend Sebi, I read it to him on the phone. I just hadn't read the chapter to him on the phone. I didn't mean to. It just sort of, I said, Sebi, I wrote this about you. Are you okay with this? Yeah, that was very meaningful. 20 minutes, both started crying on the bus. It's like, oh God. And he called me back the next day. It was what you wrote. And look, when you get older too, a lot of this stuff just drops away and it's just the lump there, you know, and it's just like, wow. And so saying it, say it, say it, say it. If you have something to say to somebody, say this thing, because there'll come a time when you can't and you'll wish you had. When my folks were dying or my friends, I'm so glad I said to these friends, you mean so much to me. That's all. And that's all it takes. That vulnerability is just always was met every time. I was never shamed for that.
You said about Sebi that he was your co-pilot the whole way, which I thought was really beautiful. You saw him in Baltimore and then you saw him other times. He was kind of like your passenger, your unofficial passenger in
the
car.
Because he would process. Where are you now? You know, so that was great. Yeah, I love that.
Okay, I actually feel like we covered everything except the title. And that was the real final question. So I was surprised by the title, Who Needs Friends? You didn't answer the question.
Well, men's in the subtitle.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
When the working title I was having for a while was Do Men Need Friends? Then I thought, no guy sitting on a plane would be reading a book called Do Men Need Friends? Because it makes them too vulnerable, too soft, too weak, all the things a man is afraid not to be. So I just thought, man, yeah, who needs friends? And it could be a true question or it could be that kind of defensive way. It just puts it in your face in a tolerable way for men particularly, because again, I thought if there was something too soft, guys would reject that out of hand and not want to go there. And I thought that was, that's our biggest challenge. And it's so silly even saying it, like, it's so silly, why we that way? But it just is though. And so you have to meet people where they are.
Yeah, you got to deal with reality. That's right. You're selling a book and you got to deal with reality. It's a great book. Listeners, get it for yourselves, get it for the men in your life, but also for you, because there's so much that we women can learn from male friendship, what makes them work, what can be a challenge, but there's a human element that's true for everyone. I'm just glad you took the time to write it and really appreciate you being here with a little old me in Minnesota here. I appreciate it.
No, thank you, Nina. I really appreciate it. I love your podcast.
Oh, thank you. And I say at the end every time, I know you'll agree, Andrew. Listeners should come back next week when our friendships are going well. We are happier all around. Harvard agrees.
So do I.
Thank you, listeners, for being here with me for a very special episode. I talked to so many fantastic authors and thought leaders and professors, regular people, my mom, friends in my life. It's not that often that I talk to a celebrity, so that was a lot of fun and had to kind of keep my cool. I think I did. You can let me know. I often have a discussion thread going for each episode in my Facebook group. That's at Dear Nina, the group. And find me on social media on Instagram and TikTok at Dear Nina Friendship. And finally, on the newsletter, there's lots of friendship advice. I do the anonymous letters that people write to me there, as well as other fun book picks and TV picks and just friendship discussions of all kinds. That is at DearNina.substack.com. See you next week.